Brigadier General Robert Lee Scott grew up around Macon, and he went on to become one of the most famous fighter pilots in American history. His autobiography, God is My Co-Pilot, was a bestseller. A new biography examines his life as both a hero and a flawed man. It's called Double Ace, The Life of Robert Lee Scott, Jr., Pilot, Hero, and Teller of Tall Tales. And the author, Robert Corum, joins me now. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning.
Let's start at the beginning, which is, what exactly is a double ace?
An ace is a pilot who shot down 5 aircraft. A double ace, he shot down 10. There are very few of those, and they occupy a very hallowed place in the fighter pilot pantheon.
And yet there's a lot of, I guess, debate over how many planes Robert Lee Scott actually shot down. He himself didn't always give the same number. Why is that number change?
He took a lot of probables, that is, aircraft that he may or may not have shot down, and considered them victories. And there was a total of 23, I think. And
of probables.
He came back home after the war claiming 13 aircraft. But then the Air Force went through all the list of victories, and they weeded them out in both the Europe and in China. And a lot of former aces were no longer aces. But Scott was downgraded from, I think, 13 to 10. So he officially is a double ace.
Now, he is often referred to as a flying tiger. The flying tigers were the pilots who were sort of this offshoot. They weren't officially part of the military.
Right.
They were in China fighting the Japanese. He was not one of the flying tigers, correct?
That's correct. The Flying Tigers were mercenaries. They were Army and Air Corps people who resigned their commissions to go to China to fight against the Japanese. And they were deactivated on July the 3rd, 1942. And then Scott's group, the 23rd, came online the next day. But Scott flew a P-40 alone, a P-40 with a shark mouth on it. And
that's the aircraft that many people recognize as the Flying Tigers.
One of the most iconic aircraft in history. And a lot of people assumed he was a member of the Flying Tigers, but he was not. And he always made that distinction.
Let's hear a little bit from Scott himself. A GBB aired a documentary about Robert Scott in 2011. He gave an interview for the film before he died in 2006. So here he is talking about the tension between him and the actual Flying Tigers you were just referring to when he tried to join the unit that was led by General Claire Chennault.
And at first they hated me because they hated regular officers. Being me in a colonel, most of them have been lieutenants. Why do we want to follow you? I said, I don't want you to follow me. I want to follow you and learn the things Chennault has taught you. But then I began to fly guest missions with them. Later on, they became my friends and taught me all that Chennault had taught them.
And there actually has been debate over that as well, in terms of whether the Flying Tigers didn't like him or liked him. What did you find out on that score?
Scott got so much publicity, and he wrote a book that made the Flying Tigers immortal. I'm not sure their reputation would have not lasted had it not been for his book. And I think there's a lot of jealousy on the part of the Flying Tigers. They were unique. Group of brave young men who went up against insuperable odds, and they were winning in China when America was not winning anywhere else against the Japanese, and they were extraordinary young heroes.
And they were flying an inferior craft to the Japanese.
It was a hand-me-down aircraft that came from the British.
So, okay, let's begin with the legend of Robert Lee Scott. How did he become so good? This is a guy who failed out of high school, barely made it through West Point. How did he become such a great fighter pilot?
He was a mama's boy, and from the time he was—
That's putting it lightly, isn't it?
He was not 4 years old, and his mother told him what his life's work would be, that he would be a famous pilot. And she pushed him and prodded him, ignored her other two children. She played favorites and didn't keep a secret of it. And she pushed him to succeed. And he was much closer to his mother than he was to his wife. And she wrote him and talked to him constantly and, I think, made him the man he became.
And he had some kind of unconventional practice drills. I mean, many people may not remember that during World War II, this is the very beginning of military aircraft. And he would do practice drills with cantaloupe melons and all kinds of different things to practice actual air fighting.
His mother instilled in him a sense of his own destiny that one day he would go up against the enemies of his country and be a great fighter pilot. And to practice his bombing, he would carry melons up in his airplane and throw them out at circles on the ground that were used for bombing practice. And with his guns, he would shoot at sharks in the Bay of Panama, even at pelicans. And I'm not sure this is a true story, but he told me he got where he could, with one shot, shoot down a pelican in the air. But he became—
That would be incredible if that were true.
True.
Yeah.
He became, no doubt, he became the best shot in the Air Corps and one of the best bombers.
Okay, so since you've already brought up whether or not you know things are true, that is a theme that recurs over and over in your biography of him, is what we can confirm and what we cannot. Why is there so little that can be confirmed?
In the movie, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, an editor says, this is a West, and out here, when the legend becomes fact, we print the legend. And most people prefer the legend when they talk about General Scott, because he built most of that legend himself. He was not burdened greatly by humility, and he could tell great stories about himself, and he had the Southerners' penchant for ignoring the truth. The story was more important than the truth, and it became true in the telling. So it's really difficult to separate what he said and what the legend was from the real Robert Scott. But at bottom, he was a famous war hero. He was a double ace and one of the most inspirational men of his time, and he wrote an iconic book. And in all the—
God is my co-pilot. That was the first use of that phrase that has become so famous.
That was his phrase, yes.
And the publishers did not want to use that title.
The publisher didn't, but the Jack Warner at Warner Brothers said, I would buy just the title. He thought it was the greatest title he had ever seen. And history has proved him right, because today you see it on automobile tags, bumper stickers. It's part of the lexicon, and it came from Scott's book.
Can you give me an example, because there are a number of them, of stories that he told where he himself didn't keep the facts straight every time that he told it?
Oh, there were so many of them. One, he made it appear that General Claire Chennault personally gave him a P-40 with a shark mouth painted on it. And according to the history of the Air Force or Air Corps at that time, it was a surplus airplane that was just parked on the runway. And Scott was a colonel, a senior guy, and he just took it over and made it his airplane. But General Chennault did not give him the airplane.
So, I mean, you start the book with that sentence, he was a hero,
yeah.
Almost in a way where you feel like you need to set that out from the beginning. He was not a great husband and not a great father. We're going to get more into his role with the Aviation Museum. But on balance, he's a hero because he inspired people with his book or his flying?
His book, primarily, because the book lives on. And as with many military people, his reputation and legend is attenuated over time, but the book hasn't.
So, Robert, you mentioned a number of times about different facts in your book about what we think happened in World War II and how we get it so wrong. Why, with all the attention that's put on World War II, all the movies and TV shows and books about that particular war, why do we get so many things wrong?
I think history is rather trendy, and every generation of historians finds something new or something different that they want to write about. And one good example, Jimmy Doolittle in the spring of 1942 took 16 B-25s off an aircraft carrier and bombed Japan. It was a wonderful psychological uplift for the American people. We needed that. But recent historians have said that because 3,000 Chinese were killed in reprisal, all the aircraft went down, that the juice wasn't worth the squeeze, that raid was just, it shouldn't have been done. It wasn't worth it. So history changes with time.
I want to play this comment from Oliver Bateman. He was one of the Flying Tigers, and I want to reemphasize that Robert Lee Scott was not a member of the original Flying Tigers. But here is Oliver Bateman talking about that movie, God is My Co-Pilot. This is for a GPB documentary that aired in 2011.
We didn't have anybody winning on the American side at that time. The Flying Tigers were the only folks that were winning, and it was a great morale booster.
After that movie came out, the military took Robert Lee Scott out of the air. And people questioned, why would you take our deadliest fighter pilot out of combat? Why did they do that?
That brought him back home and put him on a war bond tour. He traveled America raising money and war bonds for the effort. And there's a lot of absenteeism in the defense industry, and he spoke to galvanized defense workers. He later went back to flying, and he flew most of his life in the military. That was one reason he was slow in being promoted. All he wanted to do was fly.
That wasn't the only reason, though. He wasn't exactly a good soldier.
He had some disagreements. He did pretty much what he wanted to at every step in his life. He ignored his bosses, and it approached insubordination many times.
Okay, so he had, after World War II, he wrote 16 books, but from what I understand, they were all basically the same material in different versions?
In my judgment, they were. They were all follow-ups to God Is My Co-Pilot, more or less the same thing, just updated.
But his second life, he helped build the largest aviation museum in America. He raised $20 million to establish the Museum of Aviation, which is in Warner Robins, Georgia, of all places. Now the second largest?
Second largest.
In the United States. Here is former U.S. Senator Sam Nunn speaking for that 2011 documentary.
What General Scott helped instill in the museum was that you build the character and the quality and the courage day by day. Then, when you have a chance to serve the nation, whatever it is, whether it's in the military or whether it's a scientific development or whether it's teaching a young kid in school, all of those things require dedication and energy and character.
So he himself, General Scott, said that the museum saved his life. What does he mean by that?
He was in Sun City outside
in Arizona?
And he called
That's a retirement community.
He called it Depressionville. He said people there were just waiting to die. And he was prone to depression. He was in a deep depression at the time. And he got a letter from Warner Robins. It wound up, he's coming back to Georgia when he was 82 years old. He packed up and moved all the way across country. And he was given a job, and he was venerated in the Air Force. They let him fly on every airplane in the inventory. And he was the face of the museum, the head of the fundraising campaign. And he personally, more than any other individual, is responsible for that museum in what it is today, the second largest in America. More than 500,000 people a year visit there. It's got one of the greatest collection of aircraft in the country, Scott's P-40. It's just a wonderful, it's a destination for people all over the country. And it's in Warner Robins, which... go figure.
Yeah, go figure. There's this great picture that you include in your book of him kissing the P-40 when it arrives at the museum. The P-40, again, is that very iconic aircraft that they painted the shark's mouth on the front of it. But before we leave this conversation, we have to talk about the Great Wall of China, because he grew up wanting to be a fighter pilot, and he was. He grew up wanting to walk the Great Wall of China. Why?
When he was 15, he was in the doctor's office to get a merit badge in first aid. And while he was waiting, there was a National Geographic on the table. And there was a long article about the Great Wall with a large fold-out picture, black and white. And Scott stole the picture out of the doctor's office, and he kept it with him for 40 or 50 years. He would just take it out and look at it. And to him, it was a way for a small-town boy to go away and do something he'd never even heard of before. And he vowed when he was 15, one day I will walk the Great Wall of China. And it took him, I think he was 72, when he eventually went to China with a tour group, broke off from the tour group. And this was before China really opened up. And
he could have gotten big trouble.
On his own, carrying his oatmeal cookies and eating melons and sleeping on the ground. And he walked a big part. I think he rode most of it in the company of a Chinese general, but he lived up to a boyhood dream. He traveled a big part of the Great Wall of China.
You very much enjoy writing about military figures and military history. What was it about Robert Lee Scott that attracted you as a subject?
He was geographically desirable. I was tired of traveling all over the country doing my other books, and all of his
Nothing
papers
like an
were
honest
making.
Answer.
And I wanted to do another biography, but I didn't want to keep going back and forth across country. So I went to Warner Robins, which in a way is like going to another country, but it's it was much closer. So I did it because he was geographically desirable.
So we've got 1 minute left. On balance, I mean, I want to say again, you start this by establishing Robert Lee Scott was a hero, and yet he was flawed. I think that's putting it mildly. So on balance, what was his greatest legacy?
It was a book, and we're all flawed. And I think heroes live at that nexus of the human and the divine. And Scott slid decidedly toward the human end of it. He had many faults. All of us do. His were more noticeable because he was so famous. But we have many faults. But his... we should never forget that he was first, last, and always a great American hero at a time when America really needed a hero.
That is biographer Robert Corum. His latest book is called Double Ace, The Life of Robert Lee Scott, Jr., Pilot, Hero, and Teller of Tall Tales. Such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. You know what? It's been a long week. We have talked about the new National African American History Museum, opens tomorrow, how to make animals smarter, and the need for more diversity in our food writing. So as we do every Friday, we have gathered a group of smart people to help us kick back, unpack what the heck happened this week. Don't spill your coffee. It's time for the break room.
All year long, I've been hearing one very specific description of the election coverage. No, it's not bias, but it's close. It's false equivalence.
The edge of the solar system breakthrough officially cost $720 million. That's less than the cost of the billion-dollar Viking Stadium.
All I heard was this scream, and I was like, that's my boys. All I heard them say was, Mom, is somebody chasing us? We're all black in a clown mask.
Okay, joining me in the break room this morning, Decaturish.com writer Nikki Salcedo. Welcome back, Nikki.
Thank you.
And welcome back from Athens, Jordan Stepp of the Athens Music Junkie blog. Hi, Jordan.
Hi.
Hi, there you are. and here in the studio, just as excited about our favorites, Georgia State University Professor Hector Fernandez and Jeff Breedlove, Communications Director of DeKalb County Commissioner Nancy Jester. Hello, everyone.
Morning.
Good morning.
Okay.
Morning.
As most of us know, the first presidential debate between Clinton and Trump is coming Monday. Lots of people are going to be watching for what you just heard mentioned, false balance. This is this practice in which, in order to make it look like you're treating both sides totally fairly, you will present both sides as equally credible. Jacob Weisberg is the editor-in-chief of the Slate Group, and he talked about this on CNN.
You know, the structure of covering politics is you compare an apple and an orange, and they have different attributes, but they're both fruits, and you can take your pick. In this case, we have something more like an apple and some rancid meat, excuse the expression.
Donald Trump the rancid meat?
He's the rancid meat. And in all sorts of ways, I mean, it's conspiracy thinking and racism. There are all sorts of things that are outside the norm of what we've accepted in American politics.
Okay, so false balance. First of all, do you guys accept that this is a problem?
Definitely.
Why do you say that?
I mean, because, well, particularly with this election, I mean, you look at the two candidates, it's hard. It's really hard to imagine them in some level of a parity on so many things. I mean, the differences are so extreme. So it's this is something I don't get about contemporary journalism. I mean, I guess it's an intrinsic desire to sound fair, but it's really hard with these two people coming along this year.
Jordan, what do you think? Is it a problem?
I think it's definitely an issue, especially when you have a wild card candidate that's not fitting into the traditional storytelling mode that we're used to in political writing.
You are being very politically correct there, Jordan.
That was very delicate.
I know. Nikki, what do you think? Is this a problem?
You know, it's not a problem for me. If that's the worst thing we're doing this year is being fair, I think the sensationalism and other tactics are more troubling to me than the attempt to be fair.
Jeff, you want to weigh in here?
Oh, I'm not even sure it's real. And I think it's in all seriousness part of the problem with why we see so many people canceling subscriptions to major newspapers because of this type of philosophy. Some people think there ought to be two people on that stage, the two candidates. That's what Lincoln and Douglas did.
And you just mean without a moderator?
Without a moderator. Yeah. And let two adults be two adults and let's see where it goes.
The problem is one of them is not going to be an adult.
And I'm worried about Hillary, too.
Okay.
How could you guess?
Before we go down that rabbit hole, let's talk about our next issue, which is whether you stand or kneel for the national anthem. Colin Kaepernick began doing that in a protest, San Francisco 49ers player, because of protest over police brutality. Now some members of the Miami Dolphins, other players, are doing it as well. But in Florida, the Sheriff's Union in Broward County is not happy. It's asked the deputies there to refuse to work security detail for Dolphins players who don't stand for the anthem. Is this okay?
No.
No, why?
This is ridiculous. I mean, all they're doing is their exercise, their free exercise to criticize the government. I mean, you take a symbol of the state and you do what you're entitled to do with it. It's your right as an American, and they shouldn't be penalized for that.
But that's those same Americans, those same citizens have the same right to exercise their constitutional protests, too.
Not when they're hired for work.
Not when they're hired, exactly.
Colin Kaepernick is hired for work.
He's hired by the private sector, not paid by taxpayers.
Let me tell you what. If we start separating this out, you're going to divide this country.
The country's pretty divided.
Yeah, the country's pretty divided.
That's right. And Colin Kaepernick is the one dividing it.
Jordan, what do you think? Is it okay for the police not to work security?
I think that basically the police need to be, if they're being paid to provide security to the entire Dolphins team, they need to provide security to the entire Dolphins team not a select few.
Maybe Colin can take some of his $1 million that he's so oppressed and discriminated against and hire his own security, for heaven's sakes.
Okay. Obviously, there's protests going over this very issue right now. And anytime our listeners want to add their two cents, you can always contact us at OST Talk is our Twitter handle. We have a couple minutes here, so let's deal with something really, really frightening. All over the South, children and adults have reported seeing clowns in communities like McDuffie County, Georgia.
I was standing over there, and I was like, who's that guy following Cameron? We saw a man with an all-black on, clown mask on, and, like, a red wig.
And Cameron was like, Mom, will you get to my kids? And they was terrified as they was this morning. You have crossed the line.
We didn't think it would happen in McDuffie County, but it seems like it has. What could start off as an innocent scare could really cause somebody to get hurt.
Voices from McDuffie County there. Arrests have been made. Clowns continue popping up. Nikki, what the heck is going on?
Oh, I think it's a great viral marketing campaign for Stephen King's remake of It that's coming out next year.
Why is it in the South then?
Because the South is scary and we have lots of woods and clowns are amazing. Everyone's afraid of clowns. It's the best way to scare humans ever.
Jordan, you afraid of clowns?
Well, I mean, I don't see how you can't be afraid of clowns. They're creepy. I'm not terrified, but I'm going to keep out of the way of any wooded areas that a clown may pop out of.
No, I'm terrified. Totally terrified. And they'll scare the daylights out of you. But to answer part of the question, I think some of it is serious bad guys, but I do think there's some hoax going on. People be copycats to get media attention. And so I think we do, all of us as a community and law enforcement in particular, you know, we have some probably very serious, dangerous people out there, but then we have some copycats too. And what the copycats got to remember is you're putting yourself in the situation where the law enforcement doesn't know if you're a copycat prankster having a good time.
And you're wasting time and money.
Right. And what are you doing to our community? And when they approach you, I sure hope you obey the orders of the cops.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. We're having coffee and conversation in the break room, as we do every Friday. My guests, Decaturish.com writer Nikki Salcedo, music blogger Jordan Stepp, Georgia State University professor Hector Fernandez, and Jeff Breedlove with the DeKalb County Commissioner's Office of Nancy Jester. And we want to say a special thank you. The reason why we don't have horrible coffee is Savannah Coffee Roasters. They donate the coffee that fuels my brain and the brains of most of our guests. They're online at SavannahCoffee.com. Okay, so let's tackle a more nuanced issue. Next month, the U.S. Supreme Court will consider a case about whether or not a Colorado man can challenge 3 misdemeanor convictions against him. According to sworn statements from 2 jurors in that case, they said one of the jurors announced that Rodriguez was guilty because he was, quote, Mexican and Mexican men take whatever they want, end quote. So here's the dilemma. Not in any way, shape, or form endorsing racism, but science says every single one of us has some kind of inherent bias. So can we say you can't be racist and be on a jury? Or does that pretty much leave us all out?
It leaves us all out. We'd have to have the jury system completely blind, everyone, invisible to each other.
Well, as a conservative, maybe I have a different point of view. So if Citizen A makes a blatantly, by any societal standard, racist comment, I think that person loses their privilege to serve. I think all humans have a bias, but I think there's a difference between a natural human bias that's human in all of us, and outright blatantly racist statements. And I do think there's a difference. And if you put yourself
in that... So he should have been disqualified.
I think he should be disqualified.
But how do you judge? I mean, I don't agree with this. I mean, it's fine. But what I think is, where do you draw the line afterwards?
Well, the point is, if you make a statement that any reasonable person would consider to be inappropriate for jury service...
But that's the point. How do you define reasonable? Reasonable embodies an idea of an ideal. You know, you have an ideal member of the jury.
Or I know, and I feel odd because I'm the conservative here. I think when you say...
You don't know what I am.
I may be conservative here.
If I'm not conservative, I don't have an ideal.
No. What I'm saying is, if a guy says you're guilty because you're... My son's Chinese. If you're guilty because you're Chinese, and that's what Chinese do, they take things, hey, you shouldn't be on a jury. You just shouldn't.
Jordan, do you want to weigh in before we move on?
I mean, obviously, if you make a blatantly racist statement, then yeah, that guy should have been kicked off the jury. But like, yeah, exactly. But the other good point is, where do you draw the line? Because what may be racist to somebody is not racist in somebody else's eyes.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of nuance there. So I think that finding a racially neutral jury is not something that can happen because we are all human. Yeah. And as the studies have shown, there are unconscious biases that we may not even be aware of.
Well, let's move on to something that's less nuanced, and that is the song that has started to be played at Trump rallies lately. This, you may recognize this song, actually.
Welcome.
That is don't want to talk over Donald Trump, but that is Do You Hear the People Sing from the music Les Miserables. We're not going to talk about the choice of that or Trump, but I do want to ask you, if you were going to choose a song for your own campaign rally, were you a politician, what would it be? And Jordan, you're the music person here. I got to start with you. What's your rally song?
Oh, gosh, probably something by R.E.M. just because I am from Athens.
Not It's the End of the World as We Know It, right?
Oh, gosh, no. Although you never know, according to how the campaign's going, it that might work.
That works
everybody
on a lot of
hurts.
Levels. everybody hurts. Hector, what's your campaign rally song?
I'd be a horrible politician because I choose a logical song by Supertramp.
Nikki?
I chose a sweet little ballad by LL Cool J called Mama Said Knock You Out. That would win votes.
This is why I'm mad at Donald Trump. Like, this is my favorite play, and that's my favorite song from the play, and I've always thought that's a great song and I would use it. So now he's stolen, preempted my song. I love that song.
Well, so what's yours?
That is mine.
That is yours.
That's mine. It's my favorite song
might be
from my
like,
favorite
Here Comes
play.
The Boom or something. Okay. All right.
That would be a good one.
But I do think mine maybe should be It's the End of the World as We Know It, because that's what I would probably do.
Yeah, I'd be a horrible politician.
A horrible politician.
All right, let's move from the political arena to the sports arena. SunTrust Park opens next spring. The total cost will be about $672 million. That's a bargain, though, if you consider the new stadium for the Vikings. According to the CBS station in Minnesota, that stadium cost more than NASA's mission to Pluto.
The edge of the solar system breakthrough officially cost $720 million. That's less than the cost of the billion-dollar Vikings stadium.
Okay, so are we finally ready for a serious conversation about why taxpayers pay for stadiums but don't collect the profits?
This needs to stop at some point. I mean, taxpayers have nothing at all to do with filthy rich sports leagues and team owners getting gazillion dollars stadiums. I mean, the taxpayer has nothing to do at all with that. It's ridiculous.
Jeff, you were also nodding.
Oh, I couldn't
deeply.
Agree more. And what's really offensive to me is right over by the Georgia Dome, the new Mercedes Dome right now, there's a billboard that they've put up, the Falcons have put up, that says it only costs $500 to buy a seat license, and it starts at $500. So you know that's the upper deck.
Yeah.
The ownership, they're so out of touch with the average working class person, and they're pricing us literally out of the domes to see
the teams.
That
we're paying for.
That we're paying for. It is outrageous, and it's a disgrace.
We got a minute left. Nikki, what do you think?
My heart's broken because I love football, but I feel like I will, A, never see the Vikings play because I won't afford it. And I feel sad for my friends in Minnesota who have to bear this burden. But they don't want regular people to enjoy sports anymore. And I think that's really the sad part of the story.
Jordan?
If I'm going to help pay for the Braves stadium, I better have a say in the starting lineup. And I know
that's
nothing
really
necessary. Sports. So
I feel like since taxpayers pay so much, we might as well get naming rights. Why come we don't get at least naming rights?
Right.
In any case, we are out of time in the break room for today. I want to say thanks to all my guests. You just heard it, Jordan Stepp, music blogger in Athens, Decaturish.com writer Nikki Salcedo. That's a mouthful. Georgia State University professor Hector Fernandez and Jeff Breedlove of Nancy Jester's office of the DeKalb County Commission. Thanks to all of you.
Thanks a lot.
For having me.
Have a great weekend.